well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. And very pleased to have with us Costas Morris from the Second Amendment Foundation. We're going to be talking about the Supreme Court granting cert to Vera Montes and Grant versus Higgins, the Connecticut ban on so-called assault weapons challenge. Vera Montes versus Cook County, of course, is the challenge to Cook County, Illinois' ban on so-called assault weapons. Costas has a great piece up at Bearing Arms today, talking about the nationwide implications of the court granting cert in these cases, and not just beyond the other states that have, you know, bans on so-called assault weapons. So I'm really glad that Costas could sit down and talk about, again, the significance of the Supreme Court taking these cases, the arguments that we are likely to hear in defense of these bans, why those arguments don't work, what happens to machine guns as a result of this case. But we also talk a little bit about the upcoming Gun Rights Policy Conference, which is going to take place September 25th, 26th, 27th in Fort Worth, Texas. You can find out more information if you go to Second Amendment Foundation's website, saf.org. And I got to tell you, I mean, I think you should go to every Gun Rights Policy Conference. And I don't say that just because I'm a unpaid board member on the Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms, which, of course, is the sister organization to Second Amendment Foundation. But this year's lineup is truly incredible. You've got, as the keynote speaker, retired Judge Roger Benitez, St. Benitez from California. That I think is going to be hugely significant. I think this is the first time that Judge Benitez has actually spoken about his rulings in cases like Duncan versus Bonta, Miller versus Bonta, since he retired from the bench. Also, Brandon Herrera, a congressional candidate in Texas 23, he's going to be there. And I think that is going to get some national attention because the anti-gunners are really going after Brandon Herrera's campaign. Giffords is already getting involved in that race. This is generally a pretty safe Republican seat in a year in which Democrats seem to be overperforming, at least in primaries. It's an open question as to, you know, how safe this seat really is. If you go back to the primary earlier this year, there are actually more voters in the Democratic primary than in the Republican primary. That's the first time, I believe that's the first time that's happened in at least a decade in Texas 23. And of course, Texas 23 is also the home to Uvalde, Texas, and the shooting in 2022. And anti-gunners are, you know, they're gunning for Brandon Herrera. They're going to try to defeat him and install a gun control activist in that seat. So him speaking a little more than election day at a Second Amendment event, I think shows the fearlessness of Brandon Herrera as a candidate. But it is going to, I think, receive some certainly statewide attention and I think some national attention as well. But those are just a couple of the fantastic speakers. ATF Director Robert Sakata is going to be there. ATF Chief Counsel Robert Leiter is going to be there. There are some more names to be introduced. Costas is going to be speaking. I'll be speaking. Bearing Arms John Petrolino will be speaking. It's going to be just, again, a fantastic weekend. If you care about the politics and policies regarding our right to keep and bear arms, you definitely want to make it to this year's Gun Rights Policy Conference. So, all right, with that as the introduction, let's get started with our conversation with Costas Morris from Second Amendment Foundation. Take a look and a listen. Costas, thanks very much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Always great to be on, Cam. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. And this is the first time we've had a chance to sit down since the Supreme Court said that they will be taking up a hardware ban case next term. I'm very excited about this. You got a piece at Bearing Arms today talking about how this could reshape gun rights across the country. You know, there are 10, 11 states that have bans on so-called assault weapons in place, about the same number with bans on quote-unquote large capacity magazines. That's not going to be an issue that the Supreme Court will take up. Are you surprised by that? I mean, they kept a hold of Duncan. They kept a hold of Gator's Custom Guns, but they didn't grant cert to either of those cases. I kind of figured if they accepted a ban on so-called assault weapons, they would also take a case that dealt with magazine bans at the same time.
I'm not too surprised by it. I was hopeful that they would take it up so we could just resolve it for sure. But I'm not too surprised by it because the courts, like the Supreme Court particularly, likes simpler issues. And magazines are a little more complicated. I don't think they're more complicated. I think the analysis is exactly the same. But it could be they just wanted the cleaner vehicle, which is, this is an AR-15. Is this an arm? Is there a historical tradition of banning it? And then just do the analysis off that and then remand down for further proceedings. So I'm not surprised that they went that route, even if I was hopeful for, because I mean, look, the Viramontes grant and the Grant grant, they kind of broke all the rules the Supreme Court has been telling us. You know, they say, oh, we want circuit splits. And I'm glad they didn't wait for a circuit split. I don't think they needed one, but right. That's what they've told us. They say they like cases with long records. Viramontes lost specifically because the Seventh Circuit said it didn't have enough of a record. And, you know, they supposedly don't like to take preliminary injunction cases, but they took Grant, which is a preliminary injunction case. So, you know, it seems like all these rules are just guidelines on their parts. But yeah, Duncan had my old colleagues are on that case. I worked on it for quite a while. And that case has the biggest record of all because it's been going since 2017. It's been through the courts twice. So yeah, if they wanted a record, that was the case. And I think they just decided they wanted the simpler issue of whether a gun can be banned rather than getting into magazines.
Yeah, and it is interesting that the Supreme Court's conventional wisdom about what makes a case attractive, even go back to Wolford, the vampire rule case this last term, that was on a preliminary injunction as well, right?
Yeah, that one could be explained by the fact that DOJ did an amicus brief, and I still think to this day that's why it got cert. The vampire rule is a big issue, but I think they would have waited until a final judgment. It's just that that amicus brief came in. And by the way, you know, I think that's also why, because I was a little disappointed when DOJ didn't do one for Duncan, but I think I know what they're doing. I think they realize if they start doing one for every single case, it's going to lose its value. You know, they want when they do an amicus brief asking for cert, they want it to mean something. Because, you know, right now we have, and we're appreciative of the help, but in several cases, we'll have a coalition of state AGs do an amicus brief asking for cert, and that's weighty. But they do it often enough that the Supreme Court often isn't persuaded by it. They will still deny cert, like in Gardner. You know, it was great that we got that help, but ultimately the court didn't care and didn't even care about all the senators writing amicus briefs. So, you know, I think that's why, I know this is a tangent, but I think that's why they haven't been doing it every single time we ask them, you know.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. Gardner was Gardner versus Maryland. That was the one of the Kerry cases that was before the court that the court denied cert this past term. Right. So the question that the Supreme Court has agreed to address is whether the Second and 14th Amendments guarantee the right to possess AR-15 platform and similar semi-automatic rifles. And I know that there's a trend among gun owners to, we always look for that black cloud, right?
Like we are, for good reason,
right? And so, you know, there are some, I've seen some folks who are expressing concern that, okay, well, they may uphold, you know, or may, they may strike down a ban on AR-15s, but they're not going to get into features. You know, is there a way you think for the court to come at this where we're not just talking about the AR-15 as it's configured in, you know, the state of Texas, but again, we get into some of these things that make an assault weapon an assault weapon. I was talking with Toby Leary on Tuesday from Cape Gunworks in Massachusetts, and it's fascinating to me, Costas, that in Massachusetts, if you have a detachable or rifle with a detachable magazine, then, you know, there are, I think it's, you can't have, I think it's one feature, right? As long as there's more than one feature, whether it's a, you know, folding stock or, you know, barrel shroud, that turns it into a quote unquote assault weapon. If it has a fixed magazine, all of a sudden you can have these things and it's not a quote unquote assault weapon. So how does the court wrestle with the slipperiness of the fact that there is no one definition of an assault weapon? Assault weapon simply means gun that I want to ban. I mean, that's the real definition, in my opinion.
Right. And California, by the way, is similar to the fixed magazine rules, although side note, our state DOJ just asked the legislature to change that because they call it a loophole that the fixed magazine guns can have the feature. So it's never enough. But No, I understand the concern for sure, because, you know, there's this darkest timeline where the Supreme Court says you can't ban AR-15s in California, and the others say, well, great, we're not, you know, you can have an AR-15, you just have to have all our stupid compliance stuff on it, and you can't have these features. But fortunately, our petition in Viramontes does lay this out. It says they ban them by name, yes, but they also ban them by features. So there's no way for the court to really rule on this case without dealing with the features issue. And also, one way or another, it seems like, you know, going back to the Snopes-Kavanaugh statement where he, you know, said we need to deal with this issue, I don't think they're coming at this in a way to try and trick us and say, oh, we're going to deal with it, but not really. I think they want to settle this issue. Maybe not every hardware issue, like, you know, my article talks about hopes for suppressors and stuff like that. I'm not actually, I don't know if they'll go that far, but I do think they're going to deal with the heart of this issue, which is, can you ban this rifle and its common features, you know, the pistol grips, et cetera, the folding stock. I think they'll get that far at least, because if they don't, then they're not really resolving anything and we'll be back here again. And I really do think one way or another, they want this issue off their plate finally after, you know, 15 years, 16 years since Heller or whatever it is, since McDonald's.
Yeah. Do you think there's a way for them to write a decision that strikes down these bans without throwing machine guns under the bus?
I don't think, yeah, absolutely. I think they won't, they will throw machine guns under the bus, frankly, but they could totally write it. They could say, you know, these rifles are in common use. They're in use for lawful purposes. Their features, and they could list out an exemplar list of features, are also protected. And we say nothing about machine guns because we have nothing in front of us to say whether they're in common use for lawful purposes, you know, and they could just leave it at that and not deal with it. What they will actually say, probably, is, and unlike, they'll just contrast it for machine guns. Unlike machine guns, which are uncommon, machine guns are bad, you know, nobody likes machine guns, even though that's not true. The reason people don't have machine guns is because they're banned. It is circular. But I lost hope for machine guns from this court when Justice Alito, even though it wasn't a Second Amendment decision back in Cargill, essentially said, yeah, you can't, you know, the statute doesn't let you ban bump stocks, but if Congress wants, they could just ban machine guns. And although it wasn't a Second Amendment case, that's not something you would think someone who thinks a machine gun ban is unconstitutional would say. So if we don't have Justice Alito on us on this issue, you're going to need a legislative solution if you ever want machine guns back, I think, barring dramatic changes. You know, if we get 9 Van Dykes on the court, maybe that'll change. Actually, we'd only need 5, but still. I think if you want machine guns back, you're going to have to do the hard work of winning hearts and minds over time and getting a legislative change on that.
Well, that's, I don't disagree with you. Not the news I was hoping to hear. And I'm hoping that they'll still take that course of, hey, we're not talking about machine guns in this decision. So we're not saying anything about machine guns.
That's the best case scenario.
Yeah. What about the in common use test? I mean, it seems to me like if they're addressing hardware bans, they're going to have to flesh out what it means to be in common use, as well as what dangerous and unusual actually means, right?
Yeah, you would think, I can't imagine they don't, because it, in common use is just the other side of dangerous and unusual. You're saying, you know, it's not unusual because it's common and it's commonly used for lawful purposes. What they can clarify, though, is that common use doesn't just mean common use in actual self-defense incidents. It's common use if you own it for self-defense, if you own it for hunting, if you own it, hell, in case of government tyranny, because that's a valid historical purpose, if you own it for sport. These are all lawful purposes to own a gun. And so you can't ban those guns if they're popular. The one criticism of common use, and I think it's not wrong, it's what Easterbrook said years ago. I think it was Easterbrook in the Seventh Circuit. He basically said it's circular. You know, what if the government bans a gun before it ever becomes popular? And that's kind of what happened with machine guns. But the thing is, that is correct. But that's an issue for another case. How I would deal with that if I were on the court is I'd say, yes, there is this concern of circularity. But what we know right now is AR-15s are popular. Whatever else may have happened, they are popular, so you can't ban them. This issue of circularity is a problem, and we will deal with it in another case. Maybe somebody can bring a hypothetical case saying, I would have had this gun if I could have, and it would have been popular, and you could present evidence like surveys and stuff like that. So I think that's how I would deal with common use. And I think the court might deal with it that way, or they might just not say anything about that and just say, you know, these guns are common, and leave it at that. Yeah, that would be simple too.
All right. So speaking of Judge Easterbrook in the Seventh Circuit, he didn't write the opinion upholding the Protect Illinois Communities Act, but he was in the majority on this three judge panel. And you know, that decision gave a lot of weight to 19th century restrictions on Bowie knives, of which there were only, I believe, three states that ever had an outright ban on these knives. You had a lot of regulations on carrying. There were some states that put in pretty exorbitant taxes that were definitely meant to dissuade the purchase of these knives. I'm curious, you know, I've seen you talk about this on X a couple of times. There's no nothing similar happened with the Winchester repeating rifle, for instance, or you know, even going back a little bit further to, you know, breech loading rifles, which also increased the rate of fire. What do you think the court's going to do with the Bowie knife analogy? Because we know that it's going to be made. I mean, this is, again, what several courts have used, at least in part, to uphold these bans. So how would you address this, and how do you hope the court will address, you know, Bowie knife regulations in the 19th century versus AR-15 prohibitions in the 21st?
Sure. So I think these laws, first of all, a few states banned them, but those bans were repealed, and you can buy Bowie knives on Amazon today. So, which is kind of funny. You can buy them and have them shipped right to your house without any background check, of course. But that exorbitant tax, I was just looking at that for my law review article, that lasted about 15 years. And then Alabama lowered it from $100, which was crazy in the 1830s, by the way, thousands of dollars, to $2 for carry. So most of these taxes only applied if you were carrying. And only if you got caught carrying, and they say, well, did you pay your tax? And if you didn't, you were in trouble. So I think the court could easily differentiate these in two ways. First of all, three ways. They could say, one, they're outliers, because they were, and they were a regional tradition just in the South. I think every Bowie knife law I've seen was in the South. It was a regional tradition, and usually it only applied to carry. So that's one way to distinguish them. They were outliers, and they only applied to carry, whereas this case, Viramontes, isn't about carry. It's about simple possession of these common rifles. Maybe if a state wants to try banning the carry of AR-15s in public, we could talk about whether the Bowie knife analogs apply. I still don't think they do, but that's a different case. Another distinction the court could focus on is, yeah, that these AR-15s are more like Winchester rifles. They're more like Colt revolvers. They are the prevailing small arm of the day. They're not a weapon used for brawls or, you know, a bladed weapon that people carry concealed to do violent crimes. That's not what these are used for. Yes, there's mass shootings, which are terrible, but those aren't common crimes. Those are crazy outliers in the grand scheme of things compared to all the lawful purposes these rifles are owned for. So there's tons to distinguish. And I would say this, I think that the poaching laws that were at issue in that were used as analogs in Wolford are closer to the vampire rule than a Bowie knife carry ban is to an assault weapons ban. And if the anti-poaching laws were not enough to save the vampire rule, then I don't think in good faith you can say that the Bowie knife carry bans stand up for an assault weapons ban. So there's lots of ways to attack this. I think any good faith analysis would conclude that these laws are not sufficient. I think Judge Brennan's dissent is going to be particularly influential. I think I said on Twitter that there was a few things I didn't like about Brennan's dissent, but all of those things would appeal to John Roberts. So it's gonna be persuasive, I think. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. One of the other arguments that I've seen raised is that, well, you know, listen, in the 19th century, mass shootings weren't really a thing. There were concerns about mass violence, but this was, you know, large groups of people. And so they passed laws, you know, banning paramilitary organizations. They passed laws, anti-riot laws. Now the concern is, you know, one individual going out and conducting a mass shooting. This is an unprecedented societal concern. And therefore, you don't necessarily need a close historical analog. This is, you know, a modern problem, and this is a modern solution. Do you think the court buys that?
That would defeat everything if they want, you know, that would defeat what the purpose of the Second Amendment is, which is this anti-tyranny thing. I know the court hasn't specifically endorsed that, but that is the history. It would also go against what they've said about common use. Essentially, I don't think the regulation is allowed to swallow the core principle like that. Because if you were to say, oh, there's this unprecedented new problem, so now we can ban the most common rifle in the country, well, then we don't really have a Second Amendment. Because the nuanced approach isn't an excuse to destroy the core right. It's a way, it might allow restrictions. Maybe if we were being extremely charitable, and I don't really agree with this, but maybe you could say that the issue of mass shooting, such as it is enough that the court can say, oh, licensing is okay, or, you know, make extra vetting is okay. But a total ban like that goes way too far. And it's not at all in line with what we did historically. And by the way, it's also just not true, because there were incidents in the 19th century and early 20th century of lone individuals doing mass shootings. It was rare, but it did happen. And that's not surprising, because while, yeah, obviously an AR-15 is more capable than what they had in the 19th century, somebody could do a lot of damage with a Winchester repeater and some revolvers. You know, those were those were not jokes. These are serious weapons even to this day.
So, right. Yeah. You know, you brought up licensing. Again, I hope that the court, I guess I hope the court is silent on this. If they don't come out and say, hey, there is a difference between a shall issue licensing regime for carry versus a shall issue licensing regime for keeping arms. But I mean, we've seen Colorado take that step, right? Of now, if you want to buy an AR-15 or another so-called assault weapon, you've got to take a additional training course. They're putting, you know, you got to get a special permit. Do you think that is the future, unless the Supreme Court explicitly forecloses that? Is that the future that the gun control lobby is going to be pushing if outright bans are struck down?
Yeah, and the Supreme Court's not going to foreclose it. I lost hope for them foreclosing it. I want them to. That's why I say in my article, I hope they anticipate this. I hope they see the Bruin response and the high fees and the long wait times that resulted from footnote 9. But I'm pessimistic that we will have Roberts and Barrett on board to say that, you know, these you can't start requiring anything beyond a background check for these guns. I think that's the bone they're going to toss to the other side, which is in some footnote. They'll say, well, you know, you could still do licensing measures as long as they're not too expensive, or as long as they don't have too long of wait times, which we know these states are ignoring. We had to sue them despite that warning, you know, so they don't care. So I am pessimistic on that side of things. I hope they prove me wrong, though. I hope they have gotten annoyed by the Bruin response and learn from their mistake and treat it differently this time. You know, I think the Colorado law is coming to everywhere if assault weapons bans are struck down. I think that's next.
I think it was Josh Blackman had a piece at Reason not too long ago where he basically argued that not much has changed since Heller. I would disagree. I mean, I think, again, you know, when you're talking about striking down these laws that are only in place in a handful of states to begin with, you can argue that there's not going to be a huge impact, right? I mean, Heller struck down DC's gun ban, but Chicago was the only other city in the country that had a handgun ban at the time. I think since Heller, though, I mean, you look at the rise of constitutional carry, now more than half the country. Certainly the continued increase in gun ownership. I think that, you know, the Second Amendment has been normalized and institutionalized. You really don't hear that argument of, well, the Second Amendment only protects a collective right. Except among kind of cranks these days. How important do you think Viramontes and Grant, assuming, again, we get a good decision, how important do you think this case will be going forward?
I think it's going to be like Bruin was to carry in the handful of states that didn't allow carry, which are mostly the same states that have assault weapons bans, in that Bruin has been a big net gain. Yes, we've had to fight battles over long fees and sensitive places and wait times. And, you know, we've had to litigate that. But hundreds of thousands of Californians have CCW permits for the same time. Same thing in New Jersey. Same thing in Hawaii. You know, that people are carrying every day. The net gain has been huge, even as they try to frustrate us. And I think the same thing is going to happen with these AR bans. These rifles are going to become legal in their true form, not in their, you know, California compliant form. And the state will try to do licensing and training, and they'll try to frustrate the right, and we'll have to sue them, and the battles will continue. But it's going to be two or three steps forward and one step back. We are going to make some progress. And that's been the story since Heller. Yeah, I completely disagree that nothing's changed since Heller, even though I'd argue that Heller and McDonald have been more of a cultural victory than a litigation victory, because it's true that court wins because of the hostile lower courts have been somewhat limited. But the cultural change has been massive. Like you said, almost 30 states are constitutional carry. Every state now is at least shall issue, thanks to Bruin. And, you know, hell, I can buy a modern handgun now in California. It has to have a loaded chamber indicator and a magazine disconnect, which we're still litigating. But we've made progress on these things. And, you know, I think a lot of times, and I'm guilty of this too, in the day-to-day court battles and the impatience I have, we fail to take the long view. And, you know, my old boss, Chuck Michelle, used to joke like, you know, oh, you're spoiled. You came in just before Bruin. You know, back in the 90s, we were making rinky-dink preemption arguments in state courts, you know, because we didn't have even the Second Amendment confirmed as an individual right by the Supreme Court. And that's true. And if you know, these guys like Dave Koppel and Clayton Kramer, and they've been doing this for decades. And if you talk to someone like Dave Koppel, he'll tell you it's incredible how far we've come, you know, compared to where we started. But, you know, I get, though, why that isn't a satisfying answer to those. Like, I live in California and I'm impatient. You know, I don't want to wait decades more. You know, we don't live forever. So, we've come a long way, but we'd like to see progress speed up. So we're hopeful Viramontes does that.
Yeah. And I mean, I live in Virginia where things are now going backwards. But
yeah,
you know, I mean, I came into this in 2004, so 4 years before Heller, and at the tail end of that, you know, that period that Chuck Michelle talks about, where, yeah, we were fighting just to have that recognition that, no, the Second Amendment protects an individual right. It's not some right to join a militia. It's not a right that is a dead letter in the Constitution. It's a real vibrant right in, 2004. And thankfully, I think that argument is over. I do want to mention before we let you go, Gun Rights Policy Conference is coming up September 25th through the 27th in Dallas, Texas. I just got news that Roger Bonita is going to be the keynote speaker at the GRPC. You're going to be speaking. I'm going to be speaking as well. But I got to tell you, Costas, I'm super duper excited to hear from Judge Benitez. Now that he is retired from the bench, he can kind of open up about all of these things. I think it's going to be a fantastic address.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I took a shot in the dark with that one. Because I learned after he retired, he went to do, as a lot of judges do, mediation services.
Yeah.
So I email his ADR service and I'm like, hey, I don't really need mediation, but if it's not an imposition, could you convey a message to Judge Benitez for me? And he was a little nervous about it at first, but he eventually agreed to come on board. So we're very excited to have him.
So you're the guy who got him.
Oh, yeah, totally. It wasn't just my idea. You know, others at staff had the same idea. But yeah, it was we got him to come. So we're very excited. And yeah, I've appeared before him twice in court as a judge. And he's a very funny character. He's not at all what people think. You know, they think of this flame throwing like Second Amendment champion. And he is that. But like, in court, kind of like Van Dyke also, if you see him at oral argument, they're very different in person than they are in writing. Very easygoing, very laid back. So I think it's going to be great to have him there. We're very excited. And we have a lot of, I think, maybe I'm biased because I'm new at SAP, but I think this is going to be the best GRPC ever. You know, we have the ATF director coming, Judge Benitez, a couple, Brandon Herrera, and there's some more we're either hopeful for that are going to come or we already know are coming and we're just waiting to announce. So it's going to be a great year, I think.
Yeah, I know. It really is. Not just Robert Sicotta, but Rob Leiter, the ATF chief counsel, going to be there as well. And yeah, I mean, this is a stellar lineup. I mean, GRPC is worth going to each and every year, but this year, you got to make plans. I mean, if you care about Second Amendment policy, Dallas, Texas is where you want to be, or Fort Worth, Texas is where you want to be, September 25th, 26th, and 27th. Costas, thank you so much for coming on the program, my friend. It is good to see you again, and I look forward to talking to you in person here in a couple of months.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it too, Cam. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. Costas Morris joining us from the Second Amendment Foundation here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My thanks again to Costas for joining us on the program, and I am looking forward. I've never met Costas in person, so I'm looking forward to doing that here in just a little more than 2 months. It's going to be exciting times. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Baltimore County, Maryland. Now, the headline, 25 years behind bars for repeat juvenile offender who shot Baltimore County father during robbery. I don't really have any objection to the 25-year sentence here. My objection is to the fact that the judge actually went well beyond what the prosecutors in this case were asking for. And that's my issue, the fact that prosecutors were willing to cut yet another break for this teenager who has had a number of prior run-ins with the law. Kai Wilson pleaded guilty to shooting a dad outside of his home in Towson, Maryland in 2024. He was sentenced on Monday to 25 years for attempted murder. He was 15 when he shot and seriously injured 50-year-old Mark McKenzie during a robbery. The teenager did not address the judge. So he's now, I think Kai Wilson's now 17. The victim in this case, McKenzie, told Wilson directly, "You did not just attack a man. You attacked an entire community. You saw no value in anyone else's life." McKenzie was unloading soccer balls from his vehicle in the alley behind his home when Kai Wilson, who was wearing a mask, confronted him at gunpoint. Wilson demanded money from McKenzie, hit him with the gun. There was a struggle. And then Wilson shot McKenzie in his gut at point-blank range, causing traumatic injuries to his liver and his gallbladder. He spent 12 days on life support. McKenzie told Wilson, "Your decisions that day were deadly. I'm only alive because Johns Hopkins brought me back after I coded." He has gone through 5 surgeries in the past 2 years. He has another that's still scheduled. Told the court that he lives in pain every day. Sorry about that. The prosecutor called the crime simply inexcusable. And yet, the prosecution in this case wanted to put Wilson in prison for 8 to 15 years. And that's without, by the way, you know, time off for good behavior. So it is quite possible that if the judge had followed the prosecution's recommendation, Kai Wilson would have been freed before his 30th birthday. And very likely, I mean, it could have been as early as, you know, 4 or 5 years from now. Thankfully, the judge decided not to do that. He said, in part, he decided to depart from the prosecution's recommendation because of the planning of the crime. He said Wilson had to scrub down the getaway vehicle with bleach in order to try to, you know, wipe away any DNA and fingerprint evidence. He said that Wilson was seen laughing in a surveillance video recovered after the attack. Said that the teen had multiple prior contacts with the Department of Juvenile Services. He had actually just been released from supervised probation for an incident involving malicious destruction of property. He also committed a strong-armed robbery on a bus in the Baltimore area in the days surrounding the shooting of McKenzie. And then he had left a rehabilitative program before shooting McKenzie. The assistant state's attorney told the judge the rehabilitative efforts on his behalf simply didn't work. So again, why are you cutting him a break? Why do you have any belief that with everything that's happened up to this point, that Kai Wilson is going to be a fine, upstanding member of society if he serves, let's say, 5 years of an 8 to 15 year sentence, considering, you know, time off for good behavior. His public defender said that her client had changed his ways. "I've been making progress behind bars, had gotten his high school diploma, become a different person," saying he does not want to act or live the way he did when he was 15. Kai does not want to avoid accountability. She urged the judge to stay within the sentencing guidelines, saying he's not beyond redemption. He's not a kid who cannot change. He had a tough life. He was homeless when he was 9 years old. He actually tried to take his own life at a young age after his grandmother died. She called him a child shaped by trauma, said that he had been shot at 7 times in his own neighborhood, was caught in a crossfire with his mother. She told WJZ-TV after the sentencing, it's like kids who grew up in war-torn countries. That's what the streets are in some places even today. These kids are growing up in war-torn streets and it impairs their judgment. They can't develop properly if they never have a sense of safety and security, and then their mind doesn't develop properly. She said that Ty Wilson's been diagnosed with PTSD, that he's never experienced a sense of safety. And I'm sure that all of those things are true. And that is terrible. That does not mean, however, that young Mr. Wilson has actually learned his lessons, that he has dealt with his trauma, that he is not a danger to the community, nor does it absolve him of the actions that he took that day in 2024. And so the 25-year sentence that the judge received, or that the judge handed down, I have no problem with that. As to the juvenile justice system, you know, we've talked about this in Maryland specifically before, but the juvenile justice system in general, I think, is pretty broken these days. McKenzie told WJZ, society over several decades has taken money out of activities for rec centers, having more camps, having more sports availability, all these things that can maybe get to some individuals before they go into these crimes. And he says, that's where I think as a society we need to look at to potentially influence or impact people at an earlier age. And I think that'd be beneficial because if you look at statistics, things change when those things start to be taken away in the 1990s and 2000s. I do believe that there is perhaps a deterrent effect. Not necessarily in terms of, you know, well, if you keep kids, you know, out of trouble between the, you know, the hours of, 6 and 10 p.m. on Mondays and Thursdays, they're not going to get into trouble on Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I don't know about that. I do believe that exposing these teens to positive role models, frankly, guys like Mr. McKenzie, who is a soccer coach, that can have an impact. But at the same time, when you've got juvenile offenders who are committing serious crimes and they get a slap on the wrist and they're quickly sent back in the street, they're not playing midnight basketball, nor are they going to juvie, right? Neither of those things are happening. That's a problem. We're not rehabilitating these juvenile offenders, nor are we really being all that effective in deterring these types of crimes. And that is a problem. Is it a tragedy that Ty Wilson is going to prison for 25 years? No, I think the tragedy started long before then. And as horrible as his upbringing might have been, as terrible as his formative years were, again, I don't think that absolves him of his responsibility. Nor, by the way, does it mean that we can just implicitly trust that he's changed his ways. So I think a 25-year sentence is entirely appropriate in this case. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story. From Massachusetts, of all places, no charges to be filed in deadly Springfield shooting ruled self-defense. It's nice to see that even in Massachusetts, you can find a decision like that. According to the Hamden District Attorney, Anthony Galuni, there was a shooting back on July 5th. An investigation revealed that the incident began with a dispute on social media involving 35-year-old Robert Murchison of Springfield. Murchison then went to the home of a man and woman who he knew, where he, quote, initiated a physical altercation with the male homeowner on the couple's property. The DA's office says that Murchison then produced a handgun and chased the homeowner while pointing the pistol at him. The homeowner's wife, who is a licensed firearm owner, saw what was going on, viewed this as an imminent threat of death or serious bodily injury to her husband, and fired a single shot, striking Murchison. Authorities say the homeowners immediately called 911, fully cooperated with the investigation. According to the DA's office, investigators reviewed statements from those involved. They had an independent eyewitness that they spoke to. They had Ring camera footage to look at. They had the 911 recordings, physical evidence collected at the scene, as well as the text messages and the social media communications that were exchanged before the incident that led to Murchison going over and threatening the guy with a gun. Prosecutors say the evidence established that the woman was acting in lawful self-defense in defense of another after Murchison came to the home, engaged in a physical confrontation with her husband, and then threatened him with a firearm. So after reviewing the evidence, Galluni determined that prosecutors could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the homeowner's actions were unlawful. As a result, no criminal charges will be filed and the case has been closed. I know that sometimes the prosecution or DAs use that sort of boilerplate language about, well, we can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the actions were unlawful. In this case, I wish Galluni had gone a little bit further in saying, hey, if you show up at somebody's house, you threaten them with a gun, you start chasing them with a pistol, you could get shot as a result. And we're not going to charge the person who shoots you because they're acting in defense of another. And that's what happened here. Because that is what happened here. And even in Massachusetts, you are allowed to defend yourself and others under those circumstances, right? Again, an imminent threat to life and limb. If a guy is chasing you with a handgun and threatening to shoot you, it's about as imminent threat as you can get, right? So I got to tell you, I missed this incident, by the way. I don't know how widely reported it was, even in Massachusetts. Certainly did not make national headlines, but this was the first that I learned of this incident. And this is a pretty compelling story. So again, I don't know if the anti-armed citizen media bias is at play here. Maybe it's entirely possible I just missed it. But I am glad to know that this woman in Massachusetts will not be facing charges for protecting herself and her husband there on July the 5th. All right. Finally today, our good deed of the day from Texas, where a good Samaritan saved a man who was swept into a flooded creek during a flash flood. And man, these flash floods are no joke. The headline talks about, you know, waist high water, maybe whatever. This was really more like collarbone high water. More than 12 inches of rain had fallen near Sabinal, Texas, which caused the creeks to quickly rise. I mean, you can go from, you know, basically a dry creek bed to just a roaring river in the span of an hour or two. David Flores, it's about 8:30 Tuesday morning. He saw a guy in the water who had been swept away, a guy named Nathan. He's clinging to a tree. So Flores encouraged him to hold on. He said, I'm coming towards you, Nathan. He reached Flores' chest as he made his way across the creek. The floodwaters reached up to Flores' chest. He made his way across the creek. Nathan is basically, again, up to his neck in the water. Flores was able to grab him, help him out of the creek. Both men made it to safety. According to Governor Greg Abbott, more than 75 people rescued from rising floodwaters across Texas this week. And Nathan is one of them. Because David Flores was in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. And David, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. It does mean a lot and makes a difference. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com today. As I mentioned, we've got the piece from Casas Moros there, but we're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, we would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member as well. Just go to BearingArms.com/subscribe, use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. And no matter what tier of support you choose, you're going to get some great benefits. Obviously, they accrue as you go up from VIP to VIP Gold to VIP Platinum. But no matter what tier of support you choose, again, you're going to get some great benefits, and you'll be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms. And that really does mean a lot as well. So thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your work week. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. Until then, be well. Be safe. Stay cool, because it is going to be like oppressively hot across much of the country. And most importantly, stay free.